And welcome to Here We Stand. This is Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. Welcome. Well, to me, you know, that kind of sums up what I'm feeling right now. That's going out to my beloved. You know who you are. And although we're apart physically, we're not apart in our heart or in our spirit. Somebody once said, I played that song, and they said, you know, that's maybe the way God looks at humanity. Someday you're going to love me the way I love you. And life is like that. There's this separation between what we want, the best in ourselves, and often what we do every day, and all the garbage around us and the stuff we get acclimatized to, and all the horrible injustice and crime. Today I got a call from somebody reminding me that this weekend is the what they call the Mormons, the Latter-day Saint Church, LDS, what they call their general conference in Salt Lake City, where they all get together. Well, there's the church service upstairs and downstairs, like with the Papists and other mainstream churches. There's the crime going on in the basement. Blood sacrificial rituals. We have that from eyewitnesses. Rape, torture of children as we speak. Now, we can censor that truth out of our minds. We do. You know, it's easy to point fingers at other people saying they're the ones who are censoring the truth and suppressing it and covering it all up. But the point is we all do it. We all turn away from what we don't like. And we allow the infrastructure to exist so that these crimes continue. We pay the taxes. We look the other way. That can change. That starts falling apart as soon as we take responsibility for ourselves and for the horrible darkness around us and even within ourselves. And so what we need to do all the time is remind ourselves of that, bring together the light and the darkness. And that's part of what we try to do on this show, murderbydecree.com. This last week, I couldn't resist. I had to do a public notice that went out, and we're going to play that today along with some other very important clips as a reminder of what we're up against. The news came out, more cover-up this week, more rewriting of history by the Canadian media having to do with the murdered, missing Aboriginal children and many children. And we're going to play that announcement I did, and also followed up, we have to ask ourselves, well, where did this cover-up begin, this cover-up of genocide in Canada? It actually started a very historic meeting that occurred in April 1996 at my former church in Port Alberni, where the New Chelmsford Tribal Council Indian leaders made a deal with the United Church where they would not touch the issue of genocide and mass murder, that only stick to sexual and physical abuses in the lawsuits in return for money. And that's part of how the cover began. We're going to have commentary on that from a notice I did a while ago about that. But also going into another clip we'll be playing is where it all came from, the origin of genocide in the grab for land and money. And finally, we're going to have a recording of something I gave the Oxford lecture that I was supposed to give at the Oxford University in 2016. It was, of course, canceled the last minute, but it's on the topic, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And we're going to play all of those clips, very informative, illuminating, also going out to a number of people in Europe this week involved in attempts to unseat the Catholic hierarchies in different countries, going out especially to you listeners today. You can follow all of this work constantly at murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. And I hope you enjoy today's clips and insights and reflect a little bit on what they teach you and ask yourselves, how can you carry that on in your own life and the work around you? Write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com. We're back again live next week. I thank you.
Hello, everyone. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's October 3rd. And my latest creation that I'm going to read to you today is called When the Serial Killer Tells His Own Story. More thoughts on the great rewrite of the Canadian Holocaust. Now, Harry Truman once said, the only thing new under the sun is a history you don't know about. And George Orwell, in his book 1984, observed, if you want to keep a secret, you must first hide it from yourself. Now, these quotes are especially relevant to what I'm going to talk about, as you'll hear. One night in June of 1998, soon after I had started to publicly name the names of children who'd been killed in Canadian Indian residential schools, an RCMP officer named Peter Montague phoned me up, and besides issuing threats against me, gave me an accurate warning about Canadians. He said, In 10 years, nobody will remember you or any of the stuff you're saying about genocide. They won't want to remember. Well, of course, Peter Montague subsequently made sure that his premonition would come true, employing the usual black ops method against me and others to wipe out inconvenient witnesses and evidence. But his observation about Canadians' desire not to remember their own group crime has been borne out since then in spades. I thought of that today when I read the latest national media spin on the Canadian Holocaust, and these headlines were all over the country. Thousands of Indigenous children died in residential schools. Now we know some of their names. Well, this is quite a remarkable rewrite of history, because in truth, the children's names were known decades ago, as the media is very well aware of. Because after a first public inquiry into residential schools in Vancouver in June of 1998, I personally began to publish and send to the press not only the names of the dead children, but the people who killed them, how they died, and where, in fact, they were buried. And in response, I was studiously ignored by the same media who now have suddenly discovered little dead Indians. Of course, things are different now. The official spin is in. The killers in robes have all been legally indemnified. Canadians have been patting themselves on the back, and knowledge of the crime and even its erasure has once again been wiped clean from the national memory. And so, it's quite safe now for the Canadian press to parrot what I first demonstrated 21 years ago, that thousands of children died in the death camps that were falsely called Indian schools. But of course, the Canadian press is leaving out that little fact that these children didn't die accidentally or randomly, but as a result of a deliberate plan of extermination by church and state that was aimed at non-Christian Indians, an extermination and crime that continues to the present day. To add to the general farce, the very church people who did the crime are now shedding crocodile tears for their legions of victims and offering to construct monuments to their memory. Well, at least to some of them. To the children who are on the list of the approved dead, the ones who don't incriminate others, the ones who haven't been named as dying at the hands of specific priests, nuns, or school officials. If you believe the media account, those nice United and Anglican and Catholic Church folks seem to have no recollection that they're the ones who put those children in the ground. Well, despite this latest hoopla of engineered discovery of genocide by the Canadian press, it's quickly apparent that when you look at their articles, that their accounts are not quoting from the original sources at all, the sources that I uncovered. Things like the actual school death records, or eyewitness statements to murders and tortures. Instead, the establishment media's sole source is that quite astonishing exercise in official duplicity known as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or TRC. The latter's bogus 7-year inquiry ignored and contradicted the actual school records and simple math by claiming that, despite the statements and documented proof of government doctors that over half the children were dying every year, the TRC claims that a mere 2,600 children died in residential schools over a whole century. That's about a 2% death rate, instead of the actual 40 to 60% death rate that prevailed for well over a century, and to which the TRC officials admitted to, even though that admission never appeared in the final report. You can see the real evidence of this at murderbydecree.com, our counter-report to the TRC. Well, now this is hardly a surprise. Such blatant whitewashing was inherent in the TRC mandate, which actually prohibited its commissioners from taking down as evidence any reference to the death of children or other criminal acts. I suppose this was totally unrelated to the fact that those commissioners were appointed by the very churches and government that did the crime. It's all so convenient and so Canadian. Well, this kind of explicit Holocaust denial is nothing new. It's been, in fact, a structural feature of any inquiry into domestic war crimes in Canada or anywhere in the British Empire. Because according to the Guardian newspaper, in London, after World War II, an official program to wipe clean any evidence of genocide or atrocities committed by Crown forces was launched by the British Foreign Office. It was known as the Legacy Files Project. Under that, any evidence in imperial archives that incriminated Crown officials in murder, genocide, or other crimes, that this evidence was identified, it was removed from the files, and it was replaced with dummy files containing no reference to these crimes or to the killing of Indigenous or colonial peoples. In other words, British and Canadian colonial history thereby became an officially managed and censored lie. Accordingly, the TRC's total reliance on official government accounts of the Indian residential schools could have produced nothing else but a distorted and sanitized account of these schools under the legacy file system of institutionalized censorship. Now, you can see the references to these Guardian articles in our posted article of this at murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. Well, stepping back and looking at this, basically, our conclusion is that you can't believe anything the Canadian government or its partner churches claim about the Indian residential schools. These institutions are untreated serial killers, after all. And therein lies the real problem. For as with psychopathic individuals, psychopathic societies never have a problem with what they do. Being in charge, they don't have to deal with any moral or legal fallout because they answer only to themselves. The Canadian churches and governments that slaughtered generations of brown children may be forced by circumstances to pay lip service to their crimes in their usual roundabout manner, where no one's held accountable, no one does any jail time. They can even talk about issuing apologies and limited compensation to the few deserving victims who survived their atrocities. But the mental and the moral regime under which these killer institutions operate is one of acceptable death. That's, in fact, the expression used by Indian residential school officials in reference to the enormous death rate among children there. 40% of the children who were dead after 1 year was, to quote United Church clergyman Alfred Caldwell, quote, an acceptable mortality rate. Acceptable to who and why? What happened to all those little children at our hands has never really bothered pale Canadians. It's all too abstract and normalized. After all, how often have you seen genuine tears of sorrow or regret in the eyes of a politician or church official as they blabber on about apology and reconciliation? I never have. The truth is that none of us can be born and raised in a genocidal culture like Canada without reflecting the dead hand of its spirit and mindset. We are, in fact, emotionally detached from and oblivious to the horror of what's required by our continued occupation and rape of this land. And here's two recent cases in point. Last week, a friend of mine attended a community forum near Mission, British Columbia. It was led by a forestry department ranger. At one point, the ranger was discussing the land around Stave Lake, and he said matter-of-factly, "We find a lot of dead bodies up there all the time." We find a lot of dead bodies up there all the time. Well, nobody else in the room batted an eye, except my friend. She said that none of the comfy middle-class Canadians present that night even looked shocked or concerned when the forester described finding human bodies in their own backyard. Well, a similar example of our acceptable death culture appeared this month in a glossy New Age health food magazine called Edible BC. In an article entitled Planting Seeds of Change, it's reported how a local woman in Port Alberni is cheerfully planting a garden over top a mass grave at the former Alberni Indian Residential School, even though none of the local Indians would go near the spot. According to the article, quote, "There were probably bodies buried there. So many children were never found. Yet this is where Gail Gust decided to build a garden. And nobody minds? Not even the cops?" Of course, tampering with and concealing crime scenes related to dead Indians is hardly a new occupation for Canadians, despite its illegality. In Cranbrook, in Alert Bay, in Mission, British Columbia, golf courses and parks were deliberately built over mass graves of residential school children after these sites had been identified by yours truly. What's especially nauseating these days is how routine and blasé it's all become, how acceptable it is to calmly discuss in print all the bodies buried in the garden plot from which next year's crop of yuppies will be dining. Cover-up and cadaverous cuisine seem to go hand in hand in beautiful British Columbia. Well, perhaps this is all a sign of the extreme moral and mental rot that sets in among a people like Canadians who live alongside official murder for too long. The best-kept secret is one kept first from ourselves. The same nice Canadians who perpetrated and paid for and protected the slaughter of children now genuinely believe they're only trying to do the right thing. And to prove it, they'll erect a monument to some of those deserving poor little Indians. And, of course, masking the whole sick mess and arrangement is the ever-compliant Canadian media, erasing the erasure once again as the cycle of death continues. Kill, conceal, repeat. Well, this is what happens when the serial killer writes his own biography. But the question to every one of us is this. Who will be left to tell the real story, let alone write a new one? This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, murderbydecree.com. Thank you.
Hi again, everyone. It's Kevin Annett reading more from my book, The Border, just out in April 2019. You can get it on Amazon or just go to murderbydecree.com. The excerpt I want to read today is very important because it answers a question that many people may have, hopefully many people have, of how did this cover-up of genocide by church and state in Canada happen so successfully? The facts of the genocide that we brought out over many years have been so buried and shoved down the memory hole, as George Orwell would say, that people don't even recall these things. But it all began with one incident in April 1996, a secret deal made between Native chiefs and the United Church, who were the first target of lawsuits that yours truly helped bring about. So let me read this because it gives some important background. It's from chapter 2 of my book, The Border. Great Moments in the History of White People in Canada, Part 1, or How the Fix Began, Sweeping Up the Little Bones. Sunday, April 14th, 1996, Port Alberni, British Columbia. With a foresight unusual for United Church of Canada bureaucrats, Marion Best and Virginia Coleman of the United Church General Counsel Office convene a secret meeting with top officials of the West Coast Neuchelnuth Tribal Council, or NTC. The Tribal Council have recently commenced the first major class action lawsuits against the United Church for the crimes committed against children by its employees in the Alberni Indian Residential School, just 2 miles down the road from where I was a minister. Marion and Virginia have brought along their checkbook. This confidential conclave is not without a touch of irony, for it takes place at St. Andrew's United Church, the former clerical abode of the Reverend Kevin D. Annett, who was recently fired without cause and now faces defrocking by the same top church officers after he imprudently began asking questions about stolen native land and missing brown children. Unfortunately for the oblivious duo of Marion Best and Virginia Coleman, one of Kevin's associates and friends, the Reverend Bruce Gunn, is present that night at the secret meeting with the West Coast chiefs. Like the proverbial fly on the wall or snake in the grass, depending on your viewpoint, Bruce Gunn later gives to the sadder but wiser Reverend Annett a blow-by-blow account of what transpired at that historic gathering. The buck that evening stops with Virginia Coleman, who, as General Secretary of the United Church of Canada, brandishes an offer she is sure the chubby NTC chieftains will not refuse. In her words, quote, "The United Church is willing to provide some monetary compensation to a limited number of former Indian residential school students, but there are two conditions to our offer." One can assume that at this point, visions of something more than sugar plums are dancing in the heads of the native chiefs who are present. After all, these chiefs learned the score while children themselves in the local United Church death camp called the Alberni Indian Residential School, where over half the children never came back. Virginia Coleman continues, "The first condition is that you must agree to restrict your litigation to issues of personal injury and not matters of a criminal nature, such as the alleged killing of students. And the second condition is that you must disassociate yourselves from Kevin Annett and from his claims of murder in the Alberni Residential School." Our faithful observer, Bruce Gunn, was surprised by the speed with which the august body of Aboriginal leaders gobbled up the deal on the terms of the malefactor. Nelson Keatla, Cliff Atleo, and all the other NTC brass who were present that evening swallowed what was offered to them as dutifully as if it was the mush and maggots they used to eat in the residential school, but not before demanding an added sweetener in the form of considerable benefits that would accrue to themselves as part of this backroom agreement. Not surprisingly, there was a general atmosphere of goodwill and reconciliation prevailing afterwards among the pale and brown-skinned aficionados who were present that night. That spirit, of course, did not extend to anyone outside the arrangement, especially to Kevin Annett, his family, or any of the thousands of residential school survivors who could now expect, at best, a few drops of blood money and a gag order. Those rare Canadians who wonder why no NATO politician has ever called for a criminal prosecution of the churches that killed over 60,000 of their own relatives should well remember that Port Alberni meeting of April 14, 1996. For that night's arrangement set the pattern for the subsequent concealment of genocide in Canada by the churches that did the killing and by their willing accomplices who call themselves First Nations leaders. Well, that said, I can't resist. I've got to read part two of Great Moments in the History of White People in Canada. Part two is entitled, It's All About the Real Estate, Mate, What They Didn't Teach You in Sunday School. And we begin with three quotes, actually. The first from John Ross, the original Presbyterian missionary and land speculator on that land of the Ahausitz on the West Coast, October 1903. I have secured the land and arrested the pagans. He had the power to do that because he was not only a missionary, but the colonial government gave him the power of a magistrate and a police officer. He could arrest any Indian he wanted. The Presbyterians went on to found the United Church in 1925, which was also set up by the government of Canada, but that's another story. John Kishore, British Columbia NDP Environment Minister and United Church clergyman. We can't have Kevin upset the apple cart over the Ahausitz land deal. He said that just before my firing for bringing out the facts of that land deal, which you're about to hear about. And finally, Ujjal Dosanjh, the cabinet colleague of John Kishore and BC Attorney General in 1997. I regret to inform you that the internal disciplinary procedures of the United Church fall outside the jurisdiction of my department. I cannot intervene in the Church's actions against Reverend Annett. So in other words, the United Church is outside the law of Canada. And finally, the Provincial Conflict of Interest Commissioner, Mr. H.A.D. Oliver, to Kevin Annett, myself, in June 1997. Oh, come on now, Kevin. You don't really believe there's a separation of church and state in this country, do you? A decade after he learned to fear me, John Kishore was the first one to congratulate me on my maiden sermon at Vancouver's First United Church, where he was the pastor when I first preached there in the fall of 1986. If all your sermons are that good, Kevin, you'll have an outstanding career in the United Church, John effused ironically as he pumped my hand. The guy lived to regret his remark after he became a government minister. As for me, my anticipated career as a professional God-talker never came off, although I did learn how to give dirty politicians like John Kishore many sleepless nights. John's particular insomnia was caused during the hot summer of 1994, when I discovered a lucrative insider's deal that he had cooked up. Kishore used his position as an NDP cabinet minister to profit the government's corporate partner Weyerhaeuser Limited, it's the biggest logging company in the world. The deal profited the BC government's partner, Weyerhaeuser, while protecting John Kishore's own United Church of Canada from a potentially disastrous public scandal. It was all about old-growth cedar trees and the children's remains that they concealed and still conceal. In 1903, a man very much like John Kishore had arrived on the stormy coast of Vancouver Island on the ancestral homeland of the Ahauset natives. The man's name was John Ross. As a Presbyterian missionary, he was given by the Crown the power of a cop, a judge, and an Indian agent. In this multiple authority, Ross set up what became the United Church's Ahauset Indian Residential School, where over half the children died. The zealous John Ross systematically arrested any Ahauset who wouldn't incarcerate their children in the death trap called a school. And in the process, he stole a big chunk of the Ahauset people's land. John's multiple role as priest, child trafficker, land grabber, and magistrate wasn't all that unusual when one considers that his Presbyterian Church and its descendant, the United Church of Canada, were given huge swaths of land, indigenous land, by the British Crown. The same churches were also conferred with the legal power of a bank and a land broker, and were placed outside the jurisdiction of Canadian courts, along with the Catholics and the Anglicans. After all, How else do civilized Christians ensure that all those lucrative forests and fishing grounds end up in this right pale hands? John Ross was an efficient multitasker. Within a few weeks of his arrival, the Ahausits had been corralled into church and residential school, and the traditional chiefs were locked up by Ross and his band of Indian constables. Not coincidentally, the richest Ahausit land and its old-growth cedar trees were also brought into the fold of what became the United Church of Canada, which the Canadian Parliament formed in 1925, interestingly enough. Fortunately for posterity, but unfortunately for John Ross, he was forced to hurriedly leave town early one spring day in 1909, when he was implicated in the death of a child at the residential school. The dead child was one Carrie George, age 8, who happened to be the only daughter of his chief adversary, their traditional CM or elder, McQuinna George. Ross had threatened George that his children would never live to see adulthood. And in fact, Carrie didn't. Well, John Ross's legacy continued. In 1952, the United Church began selling off this stolen Ahausit land to their financial backers, including their biggest financial donor, the logging company McMillan Bloedel. And in 1984, Mac Blow signed away the Ahausit land to the biggest lumber multinational in the world, the Seattle-based Weyerhaeuser, which eventually bought up McMillan Bloedel in the biggest corporate acquisition in British Columbia history. And my old friend John Cashore secretly set up the whole deal, thanks to his government office, and achieves the cool $2 billion for everyone involved. Well, naturally, the Ahausits never got a penny from this insider's deal. And besides lining the usual pockets, the deal carefully shielded the United Church's bloody history and land grab from public scrutiny. End of story? Far from it. Enter yours truly. I stumbled my way into the whole sordid mess in October of 1994 after being a minister in Port Alberni for over 2 years, and after I had learned about it from one of Chief McQuinna's descendants, Earl George, who is an Ahausit elder who often came to my Alberni United Church. "Now, wait just a darn minute," I exclaimed in a stunningly naive letter I wrote to my United Church bosses in Toronto after I got the complete description from Earl about the deal, including how the church had made mega bucks off this Ahausit arrangement. I quoted United Church policy. I said, "We're not supposed to profit off stolen native land. We're supposed to return it to the native nation and without charge. It says so right in our church policy manual." And I quoted that manual. Ah, the gullibility of youth. John Cashore's personal role in tossing me from my pulpit and destroying my livelihood and my family surfaced in the years following my rapid and unceremonious cashiering out of the United Church of Canada. As all co-conspirators tend to do under pressure, one of the Presbytery Church officers who'd arranged my firing, a guy called Win Stokes, spilled the beans at the United Church Kangaroo Court delisting trial in 1996 that robbed me of my profession and livelihood. Under cross-examination and in an obvious effort to cover his own ass and shift the blame, Win Stokes blurted out that John Cashore had insisted on my expulsion from the church after saying to Stokes, quote, "We can't have Annett upset the apple cart over the Ahausit land deal," unquote. Stokes admitted that Cashore had also made sure that Ahausit elder Earl George never completed his approved training for United Church ministry by having his funding from both the local tribal council and the church presbytery canceled. So in other words, Earl George and myself, the two public critics of the Ahausit land deal, were both thrown out of the church in the same period of time by the same people. Well, that's business as usual in the great wide north, but none of it sat right with me, having still not fully awoken to the way things are. And so soon after my expulsion from the church, I had indignantly sought out one H.A.D. Oliver, a retired provincial court judge who had recently been given the misnomer, the Conflict of Interest Commissioner for the province of B.C. His job was to investigate so-called conflicts of interest by B.C. politicians. Well, with an earnestness that can only come to the blindfolded, I wrote to Mr. Oliver to provide him proof that John Cashore had used his public office to profit and protect his associates in both Weyerhaeuser, McMillan Bloedel, and the United Church. Well, I should have guessed what the obese Mr. Oliver would say the moment I was ushered into his Jabba the Hutt-like presence in a Vancouver boardroom. Mr. Oliver listened with an amused smirk on his face as I laid out the facts to him. His lordship only interrupted me once, to comment wryly that he too was a United Church member. But seeing that I still didn't get it, Oliver sat back after I was done, and he said to me with a typical insider's grin, "Oh, come now, Kevin, you don't really believe there's a separation of church and state in this country, do you?" Well, there you have it. And that is that. As for the Ahouse people, no, they never got their land back, and most of them never saw a penny of all of the mega-profits squeezed out of those legions of slaughtered cedar trees. But the same could not be said for their own compliant, government-funded chiefs, guys like Cliff Atleo, father of the future Assembly of First Nations Grand Chief, Sean Tonto Atleo, who made a bundle through setting up his own logging company called Lissac Limited, that's still the only company on the West Coast that is destroying the last of the old-growth red cedars. That's native care of the land operating for you. Well, it's funny about John Kishore because he's still around, but I hear that he turns an extremely apoplectic color whenever my name is mentioned. Well, hell, John, that's the price of civilization. I'm Kevin Annett. Reading from the border, murderbydecree.com. Thank you.
Good evening, I'm Kevin Annett, and tonight I'm going to give you a lecture that I was to present to the Oxford Union, which is the oldest debating society in the world. In April 2016, I was invited to come there in Oxford University in England and debate a cleric of the Catholic Church over the issue. Funnily enough, the topic was, is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? Well, as so often happens on these occasions, the invitation to me was unexplainably withdrawn about 2 weeks before the event, and the debate between me and him never happened. So I thought it would be good to post online for the world to see exactly what I was going to say that night. Good evening. Let me begin by saying what a pleasant surprise it is to be able to join you all here tonight. The last time I tried to give a public talk in England, at a London rally to protest child trafficking by church and state, your privately run UK border agency saw fit to arrest, fingerprint, jail me, and then finally deport me from your country without giving a reason at all. So be that as it may, and it usually is, I especially want to thank you for having me here tonight, having the courage to have me here tonight. Tonight's topic for debate is framed rather tellingly. Is there any good in the Roman Catholic Church? And assumably by that is meant its holding company, the Vatican Incorporated. Well, the very wording of the subject's interesting because it implies that no, there isn't any good at all. Let's search for some. Of course, trying to locate integrity in a corporation is like looking for love in a brothel. So perhaps the question of tonight's debate's already been answered. My job's done, we can all go home. In any event, the title of the main event tonight is a bit confusing, beginning with the term good, which is, after all, a completely relative and morally ambiguous term. The Spanish conquistadors and their slaughter-blessing Catholic priests thought that they were doing good when they wiped out millions of non-Catholic people for their own good. The Vatican's Inquisition that barbecued and tortured to death Christians who disagreed with Rome was officially entitled an auto da fe, which means act of faith. Even the present so-called liberal Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, speaks of the goodness and zeal of the Franciscan missionaries who worked to death thousands of Aboriginal men, women, and children on Catholic slave plantations in California. Well, some things never change. Bergoglio also recently pardoned some 10,000 of his own child-raping priests, no doubt in the same spirit of doing good, at least good for his own institution. Human beings, especially when goaded on and justified by religion, always adorn their crimes in a halo of goodness. I've had personal experience of what I speak about. For over 20 years in Canada, I've lived and worked and documented alongside these folks who have lived through the story, the reality of genocide in Canada, perpetrated mostly by Catholic-run Indian residential schools, where over 60,000 children died. Half of these children never came back because at the hands of the priests and nuns, they were ritually tortured, routinely starved, trafficked, experimented upon, flogged, gang-raped, and killed en masse with smallpox and tuberculosis. Not one Catholic priest has ever gone to trial for any of these crimes, nor will they.
These killers are above the law as it stands now. And having had the misfortune of speaking with enough of these scum, I know that these complicit clergy are still convinced that they were only trying to do good to the little brown savages by killing their bodies to save their souls, to quote their buddy Thomas Aquinas, one of the founding theologians of the Catholic Church. So perhaps what we need to do is redefine the term good in a better way, using this simple definition. To do good means to do no harm to others and to let them be themselves. Of course, under that definition, you immediately disqualify and condemn the Roman Catholic Church, which has killed more people than any institution in human history. The Church of Rome's body count is well over 50 million corpses, ever since it was made a legal corporation by the Emperor Constantine in the year 317. All right, that may all be true, sputter the defenders of Rome. So nobody's perfect. But look at all the charitable works the Church does all the time. Isn't that good? Well, in that sense, perhaps tonight's topic for debate should have been entitled instead, Was There Any Good in Pablo Escobar, the head of the criminal syndicate known as the Medellin Drug Cartel? Because Pablo engaged in lots of charitable good works for the poor folks of Colombia. Just like the Roman Catholic Church, of which he was a dues-paying member, Pablo used his ill-gotten loot to build shelters for the homeless, playgrounds for some slum kids, and soup kitchens for the hungry. Of course, that charitable money was covered in blood and paid for by the early deaths from drug addiction of the very same people he was helping, but still, he was doing some good, wasn't he? Now, my analogy between Pablo Escobar and the Vatican is more than fitting, since not only are they members of the same club, but also the Vatican Bank is heavily invested in the international drug cartels, as well as the arms and human trafficking industries that go along with it. GMO companies, Big Pharma, the biggest small arms company in the world, Beretta Limited, even dozens of online internet porn companies, all of these 100% Vatican investments pay for the goodies doled out to those deserving poor people who kiss the claw that feeds them. But let's take on directly the suggestion that the Roman Catholic Church, as the world's richest and least accountable corporation, plays a major role in providing charitable sustenance to the world's needy. Let's ask, what percentage of the Church's annual revenue actually goes towards charitable works? Well, it's an important question, not only for the debate tonight, but because the only legal basis for the Church to be exempt from paying taxes under the Law of Nations is that they must devote all, not some, but all, of their collected revenue for either the advancement of religion or charitable works. Well, right there, you cannot go to the Roman Catholic Church unless someone wants to explain what money laundering for the mafia, buying cruise missiles for third world dictators, or issuing routine bribes to politicians and governments all over the world have to do with either religion or charity. What percentage of the Catholic Church's revenue goes towards charity? Actually, less than 1%. At least in America. For tellingly, that's the only country in the world where the Church consistently publishes any of its financial records. After all, the Vatican is a closed, self-governing, totally unaccountable body, like any secret criminal society. But that inconvenient, lingering notion of a separation of church and state found in the American Constitution requires that even the Catholic Church has to create an appearance of transparency. And so, according to the U.S. government, in the year 2013, the Roman Catholic Church in America had a net revenue of $13.4 billion. And that's just in one country, where only about 15% of the world's Catholics live. By projection, the annual income of the Vatican must be in the hundreds of billions of dollars, not just from all those collection plates from those saps, but also from its massive global investment portfolio and its secret financial concordat agreements with over 100 governments that channel a regular percentage of your tax money into the Vatican Bank and all of its criminal behavior. But coming back to America, the one country where a light is shone on the murky underworld of Vatican finances, according to the same self-audit of the Catholic Church, of the $13.4 billion raked in during 2013, only 1.1% of it went to charity. But since half of that amount came from government grants to Catholic aid societies, in reality, a whopping 0.6% of the income went from the bank accounts into charities. But since those charities are mostly owned and operated by the Church itself, it just means that one hand of the octopus is feeding the other. Quite brilliant, don't you think? One half of 1%, friends, The truth is that the Roman Catholic Church is not a force for charitable works. Just look at the books. It's in fact a huge criminal racket, a money-sucking corporation that kept afloat by every taxpayer in the world. Okay, so let's turn to the other basis for the church not paying a dime of taxes, the advancement of religion. What percentage of its time and money goes towards advancing its particular, and I might say extremely violent, religious creed? Less than 10%. That's the time each week a priest spends conducting prayers, masses, or catechism classes, according to the church itself, according to a statement from the Vatican's Governing College of Cardinals, who in 2014 issued an internal report concerning the training and ordination of its priests. The main job of the clergy, according to the cardinals, is the material and social upkeep of the church, guarding the building, the safeguard of its traditions and operations, and the expansion of its income and membership. Like in any big corporation, somebody somewhere tell me where God, let alone Jesus Christ, enters into that whole mess. Okay, strike two. In case you didn't know, that's a baseball term. I don't play cricket. The third and final strike against the Roman Catholic Church, and you got to watch out that for that term because the word Catholic means universal, which it is not. The final strike against the Catholic Church lies in its real and not imagined nature. Once its enormous pretense and lie is pulled back and we see it for what it is historically and today. But to do so and to pierce the mental fog surrounding the Vatican Incorporated, we have to realize that the papacy is not a Christian church at all. On the contrary, it is in every respect a cult of emperor worship derived from late 3rd century Rome, not from the historic Jesus, not even from the early Christian church. This fact is crucial if we're to deal with the mental confusion of many people, atheists included, who ponder helplessly, but how can a body that preaches about the love of Jesus cause mass murder, genocide, and institutionalized child rape? Of course, the simple answer to that is that it's always the worst child rapist in town who has the most sterling reputation. The latter is needed as a cloak by any crook. The bigger the felony, the sweeter the coating. Talk, my friends, is easy, especially from a pulpit. But let's not forget what Jesus himself warned, quote, many false prophets will come in my name and say, I am the Christ. But do not be fooled, by their works you shall know them. Bingo, by their works you shall know them. Well, we can see the works of the papacy all too well. Conquest, brutality, just wars, genocide, inquisition, and the crushing of the human spirit. And it all began when the Roman emperors Aurelian and Constantine created the Roman Catholic Church on the murdered bones of the early Christian church. The church was an extension and continuation of that other big killing machine called the Roman Empire. Proof of this, you don't have to look any further than the Pope's official title, which is Pontifex Maximus, which in Latin means the great bridge between, guess where, heaven and earth. That was the Latin title of the emperors of Rome, starting with Aurelian in the year 275, who also assumed the title Deus et Dominus, means God and Master. One man who's become God. Well, first that was the emperor, but now today to a Catholic, it's the Pope. Christ is no longer the link to God, but a man is, elected and elevated blasphemously over humanity, even over God, by other old men in funny hats. Well, not surprisingly, every newly elected Pope is also given the title Vicari Christi, which is even more blatant. In Latin, it means the replacement of Christ, the one who replaces Christ. In black and white, it's right there. Catholicism, papism, is the replacement of Christianity, an empire of conquest and wealth relying on the means of the world and not the way of Christ. Just look at the body count. And listen to these admissions of guilt right from the horse's mouth, or I should say ass. Statements from various popes down the centuries that have never been contradicted or repudiated by any of their successors. Pope Boniface, in 1302, we declare it is necessary for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff. Pope Leo, in 1520, the pope is Christ himself on earth. Pope Pius, in 1929, fascism is simply the doctrines of our faith made the law in government. Pope John, in 1962, no man may enter into Christ unless he be led there by the sovereign pontiff. Pope John Paul II in 1996, have no fear when men call me Christ on earth, for I am he.
Pope Benedict in 2008, "You need not go to Christ for salvation. Come to me." Pope Francis in 2016, "Christ made himself sin, made himself the devil." That's new. "For our salvation. Only the church and its magisterium can claim holy infallibility." Have you had enough? I know I have. Well, is it any wonder that such a power-obsessed, megalomaniac religion makes itself unaccountable, sees nothing with its crimes, and uses the image and words of Christ himself to delude and soak its millions of dupe followers to believe that a bit of a communion wafer or a papal blessing or the right amount of cash delivered into church coffers will buy their way into heaven, as if one can? Well, unfortunately, I saw it for myself when I was last in Rome in 2011. Right there in the Vatican Museum, a display board for buying indulgences, just like out of Martin Luther's day. Special papal blessings cost you only 150 euros. The more you spend, the closer you get to heaven. Although be warned, apparently, according to the sign, apparently God prefers credit cards to cash. How right when Pope Leo in 1520 said, "This myth of Christ has served us well." Well, the most dangerous group in the world is a super wealthy cult that sees itself as God, superior to everyone, and therefore justified in doing whatever is needed to protect itself and rule the world. A cult, in other words, like the Church of Rome. What other being than a cult can operate according to a criminal policy like Crimen Solicitanus, which has been binding on all Catholics since the year 1929. That policy states that whenever a child is raped or otherwise harmed by a priest, the police are not to be told, the victim is to be silenced, and if anyone speaks of this, they are excommunicated, thrown into hell for snitching on a rapist. Clearly, the God of Rome, like the Mafia, cannot tolerate a snitch. Better instead to operate under a global criminal conspiracy to aid and abet child rapists and killers than to cost the church a lawsuit or save a child's life. Heaven forbid. And yet, despite all of this criminal arrangement, the world keeps wondering why there's so much child rape within the Church of Rome. Are we all that blind? Do we really think a lion isn't going to eat a gazelle? Well, John Acton, a British politician, said, "Absolute power corrupts absolutely." He was referring to the Church of Rome when he made that statement, something conveniently left out of the history books. The Church of Rome is absolutely corrupt, but it also corrupts whoever is near to it, like all who attend it, who fund it, who associate with it, or rent its halls, or smile on its policies, or look the other way at all its public relations gestures. All who do so partake in that corruption. And under the law of God and mankind, those human accessories are equally guilty of all its crimes. The only good that can be said to come out of this most violent, corrupt, and anti-Christ body in history is how its evil awakens people to the need for a return to the simple words, witness, and spirit of Jesus himself, a spirit that has always been the chief adversary of the Church of Rome. Jesus founded a community of called out people, a remnant not of this world, a congregation, not a church. Nowhere did Jesus speak of popes, of bishops, of rituals and ceremonies by which someone would mediate him and God to others. He said that the kingdom of heaven lay inside each of us, not outside in a communion wafer or a religious ritual. That inner kingdom of Christ alone is the guide of all true Christians, who must come out from and be separate from all these vile, false and violent churches that deny God in practice and kill children in practice. And that's the task of any deluded soul still caught in the fatal grip of Rome and its blasphemous illusions and depravities. As America's founding father said, we hold this truth to be self-evident. And one of those men, the second U.S. president, John Adams, said, quote, "A free government and the Roman Catholic religion can never exist together in any nation or country. Liberty and popery are opposed," unquote. The nature of an ancient corporate evil like the Church of Rome does not change over time. It simply alters its appearance, because it comes out of the dark ruler of this world, the one whom Jesus said, "He is a lie from the beginning, for he is the father of lies," Satan. It's a good thing to free ourselves from a lie as huge as Roman Catholicism and as criminal. As freeborn men and women, we are made for the truth, and when we recognize it, our hearts and our minds breathe freely and we return to our natural sense of liberty and independence. From that place of freedom, we are empowered to take action to stop criminals in every high place, whether they be popes or presidents or prime ministers. For we, the people, are the source of all sovereignty, of government, of law, and of religion. We can and must stop and arrest and confine child-raping priests when the police and courts refuse to do so. We can and must shut down the churches that traffic children and have hidden their crimes over centuries, like the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church of England, the United Church of Canada, all of these criminal bodies. For the life of one child is more sacred than all the fanfare and rituals of any church anywhere. Well, Jesus had his own prescription for child killers. He said, whoever would harm one of these innocent ones should have a millstone placed around his neck and be thrown into the sea. Well, I wonder what Jesus would say about an entire institution that mocks God, murders with impunity, rapes and murders children, and protects those who do so. Is there a millstone that is big enough to sink such an institution? Yes, there is. It is we, the people. I thank you.